St. George's number one station with Washington County's top talk show. The Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Andy Griffin. Thank you for joining me today on this first Wednesday. Yeah, it's the last first. Something like that. Anyway, the first Wednesday of June. Today is June 7th, and being the first Wednesday of the month, Dr. Blodgett is here. Hi, Dr. Blodgett. How are you?
Hey, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming in. We do have, by the way, over in the other room is Stockton Myers. He is our new news director. Hi, Stockton.
Hiya.
And he's also our call screener a couple of days a week, too. So, so we'll have a call screener. And I wanted to ask before we put Dr. Blodgett on the spot, because he already knows the answer to this question, I wanted to ask Stockton Myers, if you were to ask Stockton, what are the top three leading causes of death in the southwest Utah area, what would you think they might be? Just random guess.
Maybe just because of my occupation, but I would say maybe traffic-related accidents.
Okay, that is, let's see, I'm going to look at the list. That is actually number six, so you didn't get the top three.
Ow.
All right, give me a couple more. A couple other guesses.
Oh, my gosh. So can it be natural causes?
Well, yeah, but you got to be more specific because there are a lot of natural causes.
Okay, then what about, let's go a little morbid. How about cancer?
Cancer is...
Number two
on the list.
Am I allowed one more guess?
Yes, one more.
Okay. Let's see.
And it's not COVID.
Well,
it's not COVID, yeah.
Let's see. Then I will say just old age.
Okay, that can... there really is... You don't die of old age.
Okay,
right?
Okay, that's true.
It's not a...
There's something that causes you to die.
Yeah, or the death certificate.
But heart disease is number one.
Number one
in the world, I think, isn't it?
Yeah. Is this Southern Utah specific you're looking at here?
Yeah, Southwest Utah, yeah.
So is that on our...
Thanks, Stockton, by the way.
No problem.
Is that out of our magazine? Or
this is off your website, yeah.
Okay.
But it is a couple years old, so it probably has changed a little.
Interestingly, I think... cancer and heart disease duel each other, and I think we're actually at a place where cancer is a little bit more common than heart disease. But yeah, they are definitely one and two. So.
Cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's, believe it or not, is in the top three, is number three
for us here
in Southwest Utah.
In this part of the world with a large retirement community.
I was going to say that probably, I guess, would be in large part due to the fact that we have an older population.
Yeah.
So, we get... caught up in the gun debate, even COVID-19, talking about that and all the things that we need to do, suicide, these are all things obviously we want to improve on, but they're not the top three. The top three are cancer, heart disease, and Alzheimer's in Southern Utah.
They're all things we pretty well do to ourselves, and we particularly heart disease, two out of three men and one out of two women have some sort of heart disease, and that obviously shows up in what ends up killing people. But we deal with that. We put that risk in some sort of perspective much better, or maybe not as well as we should, compared to something like COVID, where we freaked out and 0.25% of the population ended up dying. So here's something that kills a third of the population, and we go on like there's nothing there.
Yeah, right? No big deal. I still want my Twinkies or whatever, But it is a big deal. It's a really big deal.
It's absolutely a big deal, and we're making some progress in the arena of heart disease and cancer, but it's still... exacts a terrible toll.
Do you have a breakdown or kind of an idea of how much of that is genetic versus how much of that is what we do to ourselves? And the reason I ask that is I'm a bigger guy, right? But I have zero indication of any heart disease in all the tests I've done and everything. And I think that's genetic. My family has no history of heart disease. And so I have other problems, obviously. I'm not saying I'm the picture of health, but heart disease right now for me is not one of those things.
Yeah, so generally the figure that we put on that, and so this is where it gets a little complicated, because even if you have a genetic predisposition, that doesn't define your destiny, right?
Right, not guaranteed.
It might tell you, man, I need to really work on that, right? So if you take somebody that all four of his or her grandparents or parents or all of them have diabetes, for example,
mm-hmm.
what generally we would say is that about 30% of the overall risk for that disease has something to do with genetics. But it doesn't mean that you're going to get it if you do all those other things to counteract it. So maybe you're more aware of it and you do more to avoid that. You can still, you know, fight against it, but it's an awareness kind of thing. And so about 30% is the number we put on it. But that doesn't mean give up and just accept that it's coming. Right. It means, you know, when it's maybe I need to do even more to try and avoid that. Right?
So. And it complicates things, too, because if you're doing a study on someone who maybe, like you said, all four parents have a predisposition to get or had something like diabetes or heart disease, maybe even subconsciously that person has been already preparing for that by maybe trying to live a healthier lifestyle. And you don't know that when the study is done, you know, you're like,
maybe it's not as much the genetics as the environment that happens. What kind of food choices do that family make?
Did they all smoke?
Kind of things,
you know,
right? So it's really complicated, but the simple answer, the answer that we publish most of the time, is that about a 30% component of most disease, especially chronic diseases, has something to do with your genetic makeup.
The one that is high on the list that surprised me is Alzheimer's. Now, of course, we're talking about a little bit older population here in southwestern Utah, but gosh, Alzheimer's, you don't think of that as a killer. You think of that as someone who maybe can't remember. But eventually, Alzheimer's actually affects your body. Your body can't remember all the things it has to do to stay alive.
Well, so it ends up contributing to all the other things that contribute to death, right? Mm-hmm. You're not eating well. You're not exercising. All of those kinds of things that it just creates a situation where when you're not able to engage in life, that becomes, you know, contributing to your
will your body literally forget how to breathe, or your heart forget how to
automatic kinds of things, but what you do forget is how to just basically take care of yourself, right? And there's a big self-care component to life.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's what we talk about all the time, is how do you keep yourself sharp and away from chronic diseases and all the things that end up contributing to your death. And so Alzheimer's is all of this data comes from what doctors put on death certificates, right? So we track this through vital records, and so sometimes things become a kind of a waste basket, you know, for where maybe we don't have an exact thing to put down, and so we say, well, their heart failed them or something, that's one thing we keep trying to get to, is how do we better define the actual precise thing that happened, you know, when somebody died, so we can study that better and get to places where we avoid those things that contribute to the cause of death. But so I think Alzheimer's becomes a little bit of that, you know, they had Alzheimer's and so that contributed to their death.
Yeah.
But maybe it didn't contribute as directly as maybe they had heart disease or something like that, but just wasn't diagnosed. So
It's still a problem, definitely here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
In southwestern Utah.
And the move and the attempt to try and figure out the underlying cause of Alzheimer's and what can be done to prevent that long term is a very important issue.
There was a news item maybe a month ago that said they had come up with a drug that seemed to help, at least I think it was in mice, where it helped mice. Are we getting closer at all with Alzheimer's?
Yeah, they had a drug that came out on the market and it got approved as an indication for Alzheimer's, but they think it does much, right? Mm. So sometimes you can play with the numbers a little bit as a drug company. And so they haven't, you know, there's this big debate, should it be approved through Medicare? And Medicare decided, you know what, the data isn't very good that this does much. And so so we're kind of left with all of the things that we are always left with, right? Good, healthy habits also impact.
Here we go again.
Get Alzheimer's, right? So, so the big four we talk about, I think, really directly impacts your long-term brain health too. And so,
let's go through big four again for us, doctor. I know we beat on it all the time, but go ahead.
Well, so are you getting your fresh fruits and vegetables every day? Are you exercising regularly?
Okay.
Are you keeping your weight within a you know, a healthy range? And are you not smoking? It's the smoking that. So I don't know. I think there's actually somewhat of a connection with Alzheimer's disease, but that's the oxidant load you place on yourself by smoking is it's more than anything else we've ever discovered, and that's you know, we talk about antioxidants and you know, having oxidants in your body is just part of the process of living. And so when you so totally overwhelm your capacity to deal with oxidants, you've created a scenario where lots of chronic diseases can be present. So, but all of that's about that kind of balance between the things that promote health and the things that increase your rate of of progression towards disease. So, you know, just as a reminder, that those big four, when they mention those, they contribute to 70% of the chronic disease that's out there. So chronic diseases are diseases that once you get them, you have them forever. And so recently I've also been adding to my discussion about this
sleep
as the foundation, because if you're not sleeping, none of those other things work.
Right.
And I think really alcohol consumption should be on there too, because nationwide, the number three cause of death is, as always, alcohol consumption, independent of accidents and things like that. So,
and maybe coming up on the outside, a dark horse would be marijuana, which is being legalized in half of our country right now.
Yeah, you know, illegal and drug use that contributes to other things definitely has an impact. And we've featured that in our magazine, but it's... it's interesting how the larger context of society drives some of these things, and not necessarily in productive directions. So.
I sometimes look at you and your job, and I think, how can he sometimes just not, you know, shut the door in his office and put a pillow over his mouth and then scream really, really loud? Because we do so many stupid things as a society. And like you said, it's sometimes it's politically driven, but most times it's socially driven, you know, that we just, oh, well, this is okay, and this is what America wants to do. And as a public health official, you've got to go, no, stop it.
That's very insightful. And, you know, sometimes I think people believe that if they just believe it strongly enough, it must be true, right? And that's just not the way reality is, right? There's certain principles and concepts and things that are just true no matter how you slice them, right? Yeah. And so... just because you believe it doesn't mean that's the way it is. And that's the point of good science and randomized control studies and all the things that lead to a good basis of scientific knowledge. But it's also just good old common sense that's been passed down through the ages, right? Your mom was right about...
She was right.
About almost 100% of the stuff she used to focus on, right? And so... but we think we're sophisticated and smart, and we get it wrong. So.
Yeah, and sometimes we want to believe it so bad, it doesn't, not that necessarily we don't believe the scientific reports, but we don't care anymore. I don't care that such and such smoking caused, I love smoking, or I don't care that, you know, eating a high fat, low vegetable diet, I'm talking about myself here, we don't care. We do care, but we don't care enough to change our behavior, I guess, is
more
accurate.
And sometimes I look at the messages we try and put out, and I think, you know, how do you make them more appealing, right?
Yeah.
So it isn't that you never should eat meat. It's just that only meat can be a problem, right?
Right, right.
But how is that exciting, you know? Nobody wants to hear about that
anymore. No, no.
So I struggle with this exciting side of, but most of the time it's moderation, staying, you know, not being extreme on most things, and trying to do a little better each day and incorporating, you know, more that's healthy than unhealthy, and you know, and those messages just don't catch the pizzazz that something, you know, glossy print does.
Especially in modern society, we look at the messages that we're getting on commercials or in the news. It's hey, this is cool, this is fun, do this, and if we want to hear a message about what we shouldn't do or what we need to moderate, we go to church. And a lot of young people are like, I'm not interested in hearing what I can't do. I only want to hear what I want to do.
Yeah.
Frustrating.
Unfortunately, but that is not the path to good health. So so we're... but I think it's always been the struggle, right? Is how do you help people understand that sometimes there's wisdom in the collected wisdom of society over eons of time, you know?
And one thing we were talking a little bit about the senior population down here in southwestern Utah, we do have a lot of seniors, and a lot of seniors, even people my age, love to go on cruises. And so I thought today, I'm actually going on a cruise a week from Saturday. Up to Alaska. My dad is 88 years old. We're pretty excited to take him up here and let him go see the glaciers for the first time in his life and in person. But I thought it'd be a good time, Dr. Blodgett, to talk about some of the health risks of first of all, getting ready for a cruise and then going on a cruise. There was a report this morning on the news about some kind of outbreak of something. I didn't read the story. I just saw the headline on a cruise ship. You have a closed environment, semi-closed environment of 3,000 people, perhaps. And if somebody's sick, and gosh, what are the odds of somebody, one out of 3,600 people being sick? Pretty good, I'd say.
Absolutely.
Then it's going to spread.
Yeah, it's true. And you look at these guys that are medical directors on a cruise ship, and it must just be a pins and needles nightmare for
That's
them to imagine
job.
Norovirus hitting or something like that. So you take a bug like norovirus that's extremely resistant to most forms of disinfection and that spreads readily, you know, mm-hmm. you get everybody going through the buffet bar, handling stuff.
Yeah, touching the same handrails, going up the same elevator buttons.
It's probably remarkable there isn't more, there aren't more, we don't hear more about outbreaks of norovirus and things like that on cruise ships. But I think it's, you know, we've had some discussions in COVID and stuff about understanding risk, taking the steps you can to prevent that risk, but not allowing that to inhibit your life and things like that, and placing it in proper context and things like that. So I think that's something you do with something like going on vacation and being around other people and being on a cruise ship and stuff like that. That is the chance there, you know, for something infectious disease to happen. Yeah, just it's part of life, and it does create a kind of a unique cooker for particularly the gastrointestinal kinds of stuff, you
right.
know. But I think even colds and flus and stuff like that, you know, that you just have people compacted into a smaller space. But I wouldn't let that dissuade you from living life, you know.
I just think
the cruise ships have gotten better over time with, you know, they, you know, now you, there's hand sanitizer before you go into the eating areas, and they encourage people to frequently clean their hands, and so it's kind of a group effort kind of thing. It's you and everybody else, so you make sure you use your hand sanitizer and wash your hands and use good, you know, respiratory hygiene. If you have a cough or something, don't go around other people and cough into your sleeve instead of, you know, all over people, that kind of stuff. It's a good way to make yourself unpopular when you're coughing all over everybody. But there's also this expectation that other people will be courteous too, right? And they'll, if they have symptoms or things, they'll kind of stay away from people and not spread that. It's part of the civility of society, right? And you hope people are aware enough to say, I don't want to be the one that spreads that to the rest of the people.
Is going on a cruise ship worse than, say, if you go to Costco once a week or Walmart or Harmon's or whatever? I mean, you have a little bit of a closed environment, but you have a lot of people in these other places too.
Sure. There's risk in everything.
Yeah. That's your job, right?
that's my job. I, for some reason, the norovirus, that gastro, you know, two or three days of being sick and, you know, that runny diarrhea kind of stuff, it really seems to love that cruise ship environment. I think it has to do with, you know, interacting around food and things like that. So I think if I think you're more likely to pick it up there. But, you know, they can track a wave of norovirus as it hits hits a country and goes all the way through the country within a week or two. And so, you know, most people don't realize, but the average adult gets 2.3 upper respiratory tract infections, you know, a year.
Every year.
Kids get 20 upper respiratory tract infections a year. We all get two or three gastrointestinal illnesses. It's part of the human experience, and I certainly, if you're extra sensitive to that because you have some immune compromise or something, then that's something to be more worried about. But on the whole, taking basic steps towards precaution is what you can do, and you can only do that, right? You can't, if you want to live life and experience the things that life has to offer.
Exactly. He's Dr. David Blodgett giving us some thoughts on how to be healthy as we maybe go on a cruise. We'll get some other thoughts on some things in a minute. I did want to mention, you want to talk, you have a question for the good doctor, it's 673-5890, 673-5890. If you want to text me, 435-467-5842. I've got one here, and this is one the doctor's going to have to, I guess, be careful when he answers it. What is the doctor's opinion on these products that have all the fruits and vegetables in a powder form? We have a very famous company here that has gone international that makes these products with fruits and vegetables. And I'm going to let you answer it because I've got to be careful of myself answering that one because they are a sponsor.
I guess I don't have a real firm opinion.
The jury's still out,
yeah,
right?
I don't know what the science is. There's claims that are probably more exorbitant than they need to be, but mm-hmm. there's also data that shows that people get maybe one fruit and vegetable a day, you know. So maybe there's a shortcut there. I don't have a way in on that other than
okay. Well, let me frame it this way. If someone only gets one fruit or vegetable a day, which is probably really common right now in society. Yeah. Taking these products, would they at least help somewhat? I mean, it's better than nothing, I guess, is what
yeah,
I'm saying.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But, man, you can buy a lot of fruits and vegetables for what those capsules cost.
Good point.
And I think the actual return on the investment is better with keeping good food around your house, right? There's an emotional connection to good food, and it's alive, and it's, you know, all of that kind of stuff. And so, there's a lot of claims that get made. You can make a lot of claims without a lot of backing behind that. And every now and then, the FDA comes in and says you can't make that claim anymore. And I don't know where that lies in this spectrum here, but I'm not opposed to the idea of some basic level of nutrition to as a stopgap because it's hard to get all of that in your diet. It's just a balance. I think people have to kind of consider it for themselves. So.
There was a story 2 days ago about how senior citizens, if they'll get a little bit of exercise, and we've talked about that 1,000 times on the show,
right.
And take vitamins that yeah. will actually help improve their cognitive function, their memory, their yeah. ability to be logical.
Yeah, so most daily recommended allowances on vitamins are based on if you take a population and you deprive them of that vitamin for a while, then they start to show symptoms unless they have that level that's in like a multivitamin. It doesn't talk about what it needs to overcome health problems, you know, which is another issue, but that the maintenance of health through vitamins or through your vitamin intake is related to that kind of that recommended daily allowance, which is a kind of a lower level kind of thing. And so if you were to, you know, it's $90 a month, you know, for some certain supplements.
Yeah.
Do you times that by four people? You know, that's a grocery budget, right? And,
yeah.
And you know, you could do a lot with some pretty tasty food in that range. So.
He's Dr. Blodgett, 933 on KDX. We'll take a quick break again. When we come back, love to take your call, 673-5890. We're going to talk more about cruise ships. I also wanted to talk a little bit when we come back about those diseases that are brought around by mosquitoes. Did you know, and I hope you got to see my article on 890kdxu.com, the number one killer as far as creatures on the planet is the mosquito because of the diseases that it carries around to different people. We'll get Dr. Blodgett's thoughts on some of those diseases like malaria and West Nile after this.
Compelling guests, hot topics, the latest news. Always on the Andy Griffin Show.
Is there a juicy part in it for me?
Right here on News Radio 890. 92.5 KDXU. Southern Utah's news talk leader.
This is good. Thank you for the text. By the way, I just got a text that says, I guess quoting from my article, does the mosquito really kill 700,000 people a year around the world? And I'm going to address that to Dr. Blodgett, but the statistics out of the World Health Organization says that mosquito and the diseases that it brings causes hundreds of thousands of deaths every year.
I think that might even be an underestimate.
Really?
Right?
Wow.
Some people, like malaria, they think might be as high as 2 million deaths a year, but they're poorly documented, you know. So,
well, if you think about the population of the world, we're talking, what are we at, 3 billion? Yeah. No, 8 billion, whatever it is anyway.
Yeah, 8 or 9 million, depending on
That is not a small number. If even if we bumped it up to 1 million a year, that's a significant enough number that people like you who are in the public health domain go, okay, we need to take this pretty seriously.
Yeah, well, certainly you could combine all of the other causes of death due to animals and it wouldn't even be a drop in the bucket.
Not even
compared
close
to what mosquitoes do. I really think it's a low number compared to where it is. Just malaria alone is really a problem. It's shaped whole civilizations, you know, but then you add there's some of the diseases,
Zika,
you know, you think about. There's yellow fever, right, which used to be endemic in the United States. There was a time when George Washington and the federal government fled Philadelphia because yellow fever had taken over and was killing so many people. And, you know, that's the reason the CDC's in Atlanta is because we're in the heart of mosquito country and they were studying the mosquito diseases and trying to get rid of those, you know. Hmm. So yellow fever, there's a one called dengue fever.
Dengue fever, my son had that in the Philippines.
Oh, man, it's a nasty. They
he
call
was
it,
down for a month.
In local areas, they call it bone break fever because the pain is bad and it feels like your bones are breaking from the inside out.
Wow.
Know? And it actually is a viral hemorrhagic fever with some sometimes the symptoms become similar to something like Ebola or something like that where you're, you know, bleeding from all your orifices and things like that, you know. Nobody wants to hear that. I'm sorry.
And they told my son, if you get dengue fever once, you're going to be really, really, really sick. If you get it twice, you're going to die.
Yeah, sometimes. So dengue is a very interesting disease that defies all of the traditional classifications of what diseases do, where the first disease actually potentiates the second disease to make it worse. And that almost no other disease is that the case. But it isn't that you get the same strain of dengue. You actually have some immunity to that, but there's several strains, and the other strains, your body so over-responds to that infection that it, you know,
your body kills
causes
you.
Trouble, right?
Wow.
And so it's made it difficult to actually get an effective vaccine and stuff because of some of those dynamics of the disease. So mostly tropical areas and things like that.
Yeah,
so we do actually have a mosquito-borne illness in our area, though.
We
that
do.
We pay attention to,
Which one is it?
It's called West Nile virus.
West Nile,
so,
which doesn't sound like it should be here. It's the Nile is in Africa,
right.
You know.
And it hit the country about 15, 20 years ago and spread slowly across America, and it's here. And we have a wonderful mosquito abatement district here that's good at monitoring and getting an idea if that's here. There's always 4, 5, 6 pools of mosquitoes that have West Nile here. And so West Nile is tough because birds spread it, right? The birds get infected, and then they end up, you know, in places, and there's other mosquitoes there that pick it up from the birds, and then it continues the cycle. So it's really very difficult to eradicate. And we have the Pipiens mosquitoes here, the Culex, Pipiens Culex, other Culex species that spread West Nile here on an endemic basis. So we, fortunately, what's fascinating, if you study mosquitoes, and these guys are really very good, but they can tell you a lot about the habits of the different mosquitoes with the different diseases. And so the Culex mosquito is actually not as aggressive as what the one that spreads like West Nile or malaria, where they'll go into people's homes and live in people's homes and stuff. Culex tend to keep to themselves, and so it's actually a matter of when you go into an area where there's mosquitoes and you're by water, and it's in the evening, so they're out in the evening by water. Make sure you cover up, wear mosquito repellent, those kinds of things, light colored clothing so you can see them and get them off, those kind of things. So they're a little bit easier to be aware of and deal with than these tiger mosquitoes, you call them, which we don't have here yet, but every now and then we get a hint that they could be here. And they were here when the first pioneers came into the area. So that's what we're fighting to keep out with that mosquito abatement district. They're very aggressive. They call them tiger mosquitoes because they can breed in a bottle cap full of water, and they're just all over around people and things like that. So they're a different game.
So we, where I live, I'm in Middleton, have not seen, I've seen maybe 2 mosquitoes all year so far this year. I'm happy about that. We don't have a big water. There's a pond in the park behind us, but not a big water source. But we went up to visit my son, and they just had a new grandbaby, and we went for a walk in the evening. My son lives about 1.5 miles from Utah Lake. It's funny, when we went to go on our walk, my son and his wife are putting on bug spray, you know, the DEET or whatever.
Right.
And I'm like, what are you doing? They're like, oh, there are a lot of mosquitoes around. And my wife and I were like, come on. We haven't seen any mosquitoes where we're at. What's the big deal? So we went for the walk, and 5 minutes into the walk, my wife and I are being swarmed by mosquitoes, and they're generally staying away from my son and his wife. And I learned a valuable lesson. If someone lives in an area and says there's mosquitoes, you listen to them.
And they're kind of laughing at you.
Yeah,
I it was a wet year, so I would be flabbergasted if there aren't tons of mosquitoes around this year.
That's not good. That's not good. We don't want them. Let's see. Text says, what happened to DDT?
Yeah, so DDT was effective at eliminating lots of bugs that caused a lot of trouble. And then we had, you know, Rachel Carson, Silent Spring, you know, the connection to fragile eggs in birds of prey, which probably wasn't true, you know, but a big movement to eliminate DDT, so it's been banned from the market. But
no more DDT, okay.
Yeah.
But you can still, for mosquitoes anyway, wear off to keep them away, anything with DEET in it. And it's funny, like I said, we have hardly seen any mosquitoes this year. But you say with our wet year, and we had an incredibly wet winter, and fortunately we've been lucky in that it got warm slowly, and we didn't have a warm rain, and the snowpack has melted pretty quickly. But we do have a lot more water now than we're used to here in the desert.
Well, and the nuisance mosquitoes will be out in full strength, and there'll be more of all the mosquitoes. You know, water's where they breed, and that's how it happens. So,
somebody told me you're gonna have to deal with a lot of mosquitoes on my cruise to Alaska. Apparently, they like the Alaskan coast.
Yeah, the saying is the mosquitoes can carry you away. They get really big up there. So,
they're big too, huh? I didn't know that.
They don't make it on the cruise ship, fortunately, very well. But when you go off on shore to do your
go hiking,
I would definitely take some DEET with you. For sure.
Are there some mosquito myths that we need to try to do away with? One of the myths I heard was the females are the small biting ones and the males are bigger and don't bite. Is that true?
It's actually true. I don't know about the size difference, but okay. It is actually true that only the females bite.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
And the reason they bite is they have to have a blood meal in order to lay eggs. So so they will bite you and, or bite several hosts.
Yeah.
And then have enough blood to lay their eggs and get them to hatch. So the reason they can spread disease is they have a, you know, proboscis. It's called a syringe-like mouth part that, you know, that penetrates through the skin. It injects saliva to loosen up or, you know, anticoagulate your blood so that it can suck the blood back out. But if it's got disease in that saliva, in those salivary glands, then you end up with that disease.
All right. So, let's go to the phone line. Are you there? I think Augustine, is that right?
Right.
Yeah, go ahead.
Doctor, so I'm older. 1966, U.S. Army. I was invited to join the Army in 1966. Anyway, they gave us vaccinations out upon vaccinations, and they gave us a lot of big talks about tuberculosis in Southeast Asia. Anyway, so I end up working at Fitzsimmons General Hospital, which was the TB center for the Army in Colorado, Denver. So I cannot get a clean... These TB tests keep coming back indeterminate. And the VA finally gave me a skin test after all the others, the you know, gold standard ones.
Yeah.
And they say that I'm negative, but I had TB in 1967, or I was in a room with a guy that died the very next day from it. Does that mean I had it, or... I'm never going to be have a clean TB test or what?
Yeah, that's a great question. So two factors could influence whether, you know, how easy it is to determine whether you have TB. And TB gets really complicated as you're finding out. So if you had the BCG vaccine, which some military did, some didn't, but that's a vaccine used around the world to prevent particularly childhood TB. And if you were exposed, so if you were exposed and you've had positive tests, generally you have, you know, an infection. So there's a difference between an infection with TB and active TB disease. So we call it latent TB because about 90% of people that get infected won't ever really progress to active disease, but 10% do. And so they you harbor the TB in your body, and we treat that, right? It's much easier to treat it as a latent infection, as a infection in your body, than it is an active infection. So, if they're calling you negative, they're saying you're not having a response and you're negative, then you probably haven't really ever been infected with TB. But the indeterminate is interesting. So, if they've given you the better standard is actually what's called a QFTD, a quantiferon gold. And that will tell you better if you actually have, you know, had an active infection versus some sort of passive immunity or something like that through an immunization or something like that. So if you haven't had a QFT, that would be my recommendation, is to get a QFT, and that'll give you a more definitive answer. But
I believe I've had that test twice, and it's come back indeterminate.
Yeah.
And then they went to the skin test. Now, back in 1966, when they were dealing with this in the Army, they pounded into us that this stuff can lay in your body for 50 or 60 years, which I guess that's what that would be me, 50 or 60 years.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's the latent infection that I was talking about. Yeah, it hangs out until it gets a chance to come out in about 10% of people. So... well, if they're willing to call it negative, you've had people read several tests and they've called it negative, I would take that and run with it, you know. And
the problem I'm having is I have psoriatic arthritis from getting hurt in the Army, and they were giving me these drugs that screw up your immune system.
Yeah.
And makes it so you're more susceptible to infections. So I should stay away from all of those drugs. Correct, like Humira and everything.
No, I wouldn't say that. If they're giving you a negative read on this and they're saying you don't have TB, you're fine. And even if you do, even if you have a latent infection, I wouldn't let it hinder your progress towards good treatment, right? So we still have medications that we can treat TB with and things like that. We're just trying to get the lowest number of people possible. But if you do ever have symptoms that are indicative of TB, you know, night sweats, cough that doesn't resolve, those kinds of things, I would pay attention to that very seriously. But where somebody, you know, in a competent medical position has said, you know what, we just don't think you have TB, I would run with that and live life accordingly.
Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to line two. Diana's been hanging on. Thank you, Diana, for waiting. What's up?
Hi. Hello, Dr. Blodgett.
Hi.
Hi there. I was just wanting to ask you, since the COVID inoculations are still being given, what is the informed consent that you give one before they take the shot?
Well, there's a vaccine information sheet that's required to be given out to everybody. It gives a list of potential side effects, and you know, which is generally pretty mild. But there's a list of information that's out there that everybody should be aware of.
What that you know, as far as the COVID shot is concerned, in giving that instead of the contraindications inside the box, that's not given to the individuals, and they go to, let's say, the pharmacy and they give out inoculations. They're not giving out those lists of things. And in fact, I did get a printout from them, and it was very generalized because the
we lost her. All right, I guess we'll move on. Yeah, I don't know what happened to the connection there, but I know that it still continues to this day to be a controversial deal. Do I take that shot, the COVID shot? Do I not take the shot? I know there are a lot of people. I have a member of my family who is he's not anti-vax as far as the childhood disease vaccinations, yeah, but anti-vax as far as COVID, and that's certainly within their right, for sure.
Yeah, everybody has to make their own choices, and that's where we tried to always come down was, take it if you want it. That's our recommendation. If you don't, don't. But people can't leave it alone, for sure.
We'll be right back. All right, short on time. A couple things we wanted to get to before we wrap the show up. Number one, we did talk a little bit about cruises earlier in the show. Basically, Dr. Blodgett's conclusion, if you don't mind me kind of summarizing, was go on your cruises. Just if you need to, take a little extra care in washing up and making sure that you know, your immunizations are up to date. Not necessarily COVID, but whatever immunizations you need, and just trying to be clean. It is National Diabetes Month, and Dr. Blodgett wanted to talk a little bit about diabetes, because unfortunately it's not type 1, 1 in 50 people or whatever have it. We're talking about type 2 now.
Yeah, well, you know, we're looking at 10 or 15% of the population that has diabetes.
That's huge.
30% that has pre-diabetes. Mm. 25% of the healthcare dollar is that one disease, and that's going to go to 50-60% of the healthcare dollar. It's a growing problem that's getting worse, and it has such a dramatic impact on people's lives. So we're ramping up into November when they have International Diabetes Day, and we'll be talking more about diabetes. But right now we're highlighting the fact that we have free screenings for whether you're more likely to have diabetes on our website, and very low-cost screenings in the health department. So $25 for an A1C test, you know, they're, what, $300 at the hospital and kind of thing. Come on in, let us give a really kind of basic assessment of your diabetes risk, but let you know that is about 80% of people with prediabetes, and probably 60% of people with diabetes don't know they have it. It's silent, and we really want to raise awareness of this terrible disease.